The Civic Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Brendan. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you'll be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it's time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is James R.
Hey guys, James Alcoholic.
James.
Thanks so much, Mary, for asking me to do this. Thanks to my sponsor, Alan. I didn't get a chance to thank him last week when I took a cake for 8 years, but I appreciate everything he does for me as well. I have had a less than spiritual day. I am moving to Albuquerque at the moment. At 5 o'clock in the morning, I leave. And moving is just super, super stressful. But anyway, getting through it. This has been my home group for about 6 years now, and I love you guys. This is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. I come from Wisconsin. If you've never been to Wisconsin, it's sort of similar to the Shire, I guess. And people are sort of like hobbits. We like cheese quite a bit and really, really, really like beer. We like beer a lot. And those are sort of sacred things. And they're really, really great people. Alcohol in Wisconsin is sort of similar to what I imagine meth is going to be like in Albuquerque. You know, it's just most people just brew it in their basement or something. So anyway, I had a really, really great childhood. My parents are fantastic. My family is wonderful. They're super, super supportive. I had everything provided for me. And for some reason, I was just, I was suicidal for reasons that I could not really tell. You know, I was definitely different but things were good. You know, I was a classical musician. I played French horn, which is the one that looks like Dr. Seuss made it. And, it's overweight. I was very, very heavy. And you know, I had trouble with relationships and maintaining relationships, but I was also suicidal, you know, I was just really never destined to, I felt like I was born in the wrong time period. You know, I didn't relate to rap music and reality television. And so I was very much alienated. I was also very, very uptight, very, very uptight. And had this weird obsession with Ludwig von Beethoven. And, it's not a recipe for popularity, you know what I mean? And I was ready to kill myself by the time I was 15 years old. When I was 15, I did something magical, which is that I snuck into my parents' basement and I tapped into my father's Miller High Life, which, as many of you know, is the champagne of beers. And it really did something wonderful for me. I intended to have one to find out what it was like, and I ended up having 8. And after that day, right on the dot, I had this incredible change in personality where I discovered Tom Petty and Bob Dylan and Pink Floyd and the Beatles and all those guys. And I just had a complete change in personality. And it was drastic, you know, it was like jarring. And I was off to the races. A year and a half later, my parents put me in rehab. Inpatient rehab. And, that's very quick. That's gotta be some sort of record. And, about a year after I got out of rehab, I crashed my car. And, to give you a little backstory, French horn, I was very, very good at French horn for whatever reason. And one of the reasons was, it requires a certain embouchure, sort of like a quarterback shoulder. It's you either have it or you don't. And, so when I got into my car crash, I wasn't wearing a seatbelt. Hit the windshield and I came down and the steering wheel forced up my jaw and I bit off my own tongue. And my father met me at the hospital and watched it get sewn back on and all that kind of stuff. It was really just horrible, really unfortunate what I put them through. You know, I'm sure they're quite grateful for everything that you guys have done for me. So, you know, my drinking's a mess. I drank until I was 21 years old and I build my life up and then I tear it down through a senseless series of sprees over and over again. And finally, I tried to quit drinking. It was about 6 months after my 21st birthday, and I could only get 6 months. That was my maximum. That's sort of my fuse. And after 6 months, I went back to it. And, you know, it was troubling to me because I couldn't stay. You know, I knew there was something weird with alcohol. I didn't really like alcohol at that time because I had had a lot of consequences and I had done a lot of negative stuff to my life. Although I identify as alcohol being a solution to my problems, which is life. But, there was just a lot of consequences. So, I went and saw a psychiatrist and I couldn't be really honest with her because they can put you in a psych ward or which is actually wouldn't be that bad. I've been in psych wards lately and I feel very comfortable in them, which I think is somewhat abnormal reaction, but it's how I don't know. I just feel comfortable among my people, I guess. And so I couldn't be totally honest with her, but I was just a little honest about my drinking and what was going on. And she recommended I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went, and this guy named Malcolm met, bought me a book at my very first meeting. And, you know, I'm internally grateful for that. And he became my sponsor. And, I didn't stay sober. I have this thing about me. I am just chronically unique. I am just totally special in every way, shape, or form. For me, I was an alcoholic and a genius. And that's as bad as anything else. You know, if I'm an alcoholic and anything else, I really can't stay sober. That's my experience because I don't need to do what you need to do in order to stay sober. And so I stayed drunk for another 3 years. And finally, I got sober one more time, tried it again. And I met this guy named Zach and Zach, he let me stand next to him at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know if any of you relate to this, but I find that standing alone at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is the worst feeling I've ever had in my entire life. Mm-hmm. It was really the intersection of heaven and hell because I could see how great everyone else's life is. And my life was just god awful, but he would just let me stand there and not talk. And he knew exactly what was going on because I had no idea how to have a conversation. And, he became my sponsor just because of that simple act of kindness. And we started to have a conversation and we started talking about my drinking and my life. And I remember something that significantly changed the course of my sobriety was he said to me once that, look, man, I know you have a problem with drugs. I know you have a problem with relationships and finances and work and family and all this other stuff, but just set all that aside for a short period of time and focus on alcohol, the beverage, focus on alcohol. And that sounded like the stupidest thing to me ever because alcohol had never really been my problem, but I was beaten into a state of reasonableness. And so, I did it. And he told me to listen with my heart, not my head, because there's nothing intellectual about this. And I like to think I'm very intellectual, even though I graduated with a 2.2 GPA from high school. It really alcohol opened the door for sobriety because I made a diagnosis. I made a diagnosis that I was an alcoholic, and there's no doubt in my heart now that I am an alcoholic. And I think it's why I stayed sober. So it was the best piece of advice anyone's ever given me. My life started to change, and things got better. Year two was the worst year of my life though. It was so bad. I had so many character defects that I was still living with on a daily basis and not willing to get rid of. And things weren't, the world wasn't working the way that I wanted it to. And all this, I started getting resentful at AA because I was trying to impress old timers and that kind of thing, which is fine. Like I actually don't have a problem with that. I think it's healthy for newcomers to whatever gets you to do the action, man. The actions don't care why you take them. That's been my experience at least. And, my life got better, and my sponsor started having a conversation about relationships and how I needed to adjust those relationships. And so I made amends and all that kind of stuff. And it just, right around year five, my life blew up. Somebody in this group made a recommendation that I do something work related and my life took off. If you knew here tonight, man, if sobriety was easy, you wouldn't be here. Sobriety is difficult. It is very, very difficult. That's 1 minute, correct? Mm-hmm. Oh God. For some reason I didn't hear that. Sobriety is very, very difficult in my experience. Again, you would not be here if that were not the case, but your sobriety is important to us. And what I would recommend personally from my personal experience is that you know, we know you have a problem with drugs and with finances and sex and relationships, all that kind of stuff. We know that, you know, just set all that aside and focus on alcohol. And when you listen, there's going to be two great speakers that follow me. Listen with your heart, not your head, because there's nothing intellectual about this. You know, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me in my life. I love you guys so much. I'm going to miss you so much. And thank you so much for being exactly the people that you say you are. You know, if you're new, you can trust absolutely everything these people say about themselves. So that's all I got. I love you guys.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Nancy C.
Hi, everybody. I'm Nancy Cook. I'm an alcoholic. Woo! So grateful to be here. So grateful to be sharing Pacific Group. I went to my first live meeting on Monday night after having been only doing Zoom for a year or however long we'd been shut down. And the main speaker says his name. And instead of saying, "Hi, Bill," I waved and quickly took my hand down because I was embarrassed, but not quick enough for my mate Hilda sitting next to me to say, "Did you just wave?" You know what I mean? I got to get back in the groove of saying, "Hi, Nancy," or whoever it is speaking. And so grateful to be here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for your share. James, that was really awesome. And you used the word that I used to describe my drinking, which was magical. My first drink was that I was at a college party when I was 20, and I was a big goober, heavy, misfit, self-absorbed, self-centered, full of fear, thought about myself all the time. And, you know, I drank some Strawberry Hill wine, and the whole room came around me and started dancing in a circle, calling out my name, going, "Nancy, Nancy, Nancy," which didn't happen, but it happened for me that night. That's the magic of alcohol for me. And, you know, from that day on, you know, I wanted to have the effect produced by alcohol. I loved what it did for me. I didn't know how bad I felt until I felt good. And it just was magical. And so I started, you know, drinking regularly. And, you know, within 6 months of my drinking, I turned my life upside down, just, you know, moved in with a crazy guy that was violent, dropped out of college, started working in a nude modeling studio, got arrested for prostitution, got rid of that crazy guy, got another crazy violent guy, which, you know, seemed to be a pattern for me. You know, I used to wonder why I was at all these crazy people that liked me. I felt like I was a victim until, you know, I realized, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm a magnet for crazy people, drunk or sober. The craziest newcomer women that come into the rooms, I can go in the bathroom and lock myself in the door, and they will beat the door down for me, you know. You know, my sponsor Sharon gets the ones with the little scarves and the beautiful ones, and I get the, you don't even know. And, you know, I'm just a magnet for it. And, you know, so I'm a daily drinker and I'm a daily drunk and just in and out of the bars, in and out of the clubs. But what happened for me is, as a result of the prostitution arrest, I couldn't work in any nude modeling studio anymore. And so I really didn't have any other job skills besides that. And so I ended up getting a job as a graveyard waitress at Norm's Restaurant in Santa Ana. And the very first day of the very first night that we opened, it was a new restaurant, and we opened the restaurant, and you know, I had a black eye and broken glasses from my boyfriend that beat me up. And it was just, you know, crazy. But what happened is my work started to see something in me and started to, you know, developed me to be the first woman manager for my company. So at night I'm out in the clubs, you know, I had this Datsun B210 hatchback, and I laid the back seat down, and I used to have all my clubbing clothes. I used to have my dress for success suits, because I never knew where I was going to be. And I was always prepared. You know, if you took me home for a one night stand, I didn't come out in the same clothes. I mean, you know, that's embarrassing. If you took me for a one night stand, I would have my dress for success suit. Oh my God. And so, you know, that's how my drinking went. And what finally happened for me is I made manager. I had been working for this for 10 years. I was 29 years old, and there was a big thud, because that wasn't it. You know, I had spent my whole life looking out there for something to fix this inside, and that wasn't it. And, you know, long story short, I had a Christmas party for the employees. I ended up exposing myself because the top of my dress fell down to all my employees. And then I'm driving home and I'm, you know, I was only going to be at the party for a minute, but I was still there 8 hours later. And I knew I was either, you know, I was in trouble from my boyfriend. I got pulled over by the police and I'm taking the sobriety test and I'm flunking it. And, you know, I really feel that alcohol saved my life. Like, it really saved my life. There was something wrong with me that was, that alcohol fixed. And I'm grateful to it. And it had been the answer to all my problems. You know, bad day at work, I drank. You know, fight with my boyfriend, I drank. But that night, you know, I just exposed myself to the employees. I'm either going to go to jail or get beat up. And just for one split second, I saw that alcohol was the problem and not the solution. And I had never seen it like that before. You know, so I, you know, got to finally, after a long time of trying to do AA light, I finally surrendered to Alcoholics Anonymous, thinking that I would be sober and somber the rest of my life because I had never been happy before I drank. By no other reason other than I have bad perception and an exhausting amount of self-centeredness and bad thinking, which left untreated is still my claim to fame in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm still in the remedial group and, you know, it used to bother me. I don't mind anymore because some of my favorite people in this program and some even in this room are right there with me. You know, we just don't get things right, you know, and we just struggle. And, you know that line in the book that says we needn't be bludgeoned into humility. Well, I always have to be bludgeoned. You know what I mean? Like I don't do anything unless it's painful. Then I take a look at what's going on with me. And, last year, like I said, I've been with my company for 45 years and I had the same boss, Jerry, for 41 of those 45 years. And my boss just loved me. He was the vice president, district supervisor, and he just loved me. And it was just a beautiful, my time at Norm's has just been beautiful, right? Until we got bought by a corporation 5 years ago. But anyway, so Jerry tells me back in October of last year that he's retiring. And I was just really bummed because he's just been the wind beneath my wings. It's just, he's just an amazing boss. And that night I go to bed like a normal night, but then I wake up in the night and the new boss I'm going to get is a guy named Chip. And everybody hates Chip because he's like this micromanager. They say, oh, you're going to get 10 emails a day from Chip telling you what to do and this and that. And so I laid awake that night in bed like, oh my God, Chip's only been with the company 5 years. You've been with the company 45 years. And so I start planning all the things I'm going to say to Chip when he gives me any direction. Like if he says something about my labor cost being too high at the restaurant, I'm going to say, well, you know what, Chip, I had to lay off 90 of my 100 employees and the last 10 that worked all through COVID, perhaps they don't qualify for unemployment, if you know what I mean. And so these guys are trying to support their families. And so, yeah, maybe I gave him too many hours. And then if he said something about my food cost, I had to answer for him too, right? I've got to answer for everything that he's going to say to me. And then my next thought is, he's not even my boss yet. He's not even going to be my boss for a month. Like the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, have the power to kill. Like I'm already worked up into a frenzy. Jerry hasn't even retired yet, right? So I'm like, oh my God, Nancy, right? You know what I mean? Like, let's stay in the day. And my next thought was, shame on you, Nancy Cook, right? Like, how would I like it if I had an employee like me or a sponsee like me? Like if I said, hey, Onyx, you know what? I think that your program would be better if you went to a few more meetings and worked with others and got a few more commitments. And what if Onyx said, well, you know, I'd like to, but, you know, I go to school full time and I got a boyfriend and you know what I mean? Like I have to take care of people. You know what I mean? Like, how would I like that? You know, and I saw myself clearly. And the beauty of that is for me was I still want to be teachable in this program, right? I don't want to, my pride is out to get me. It always has been. At night, sometimes I go to bed and I'm just, you know, I've been to a meeting. I've talked to others. I sponsor. I do all the stuff that a good Alcoholics Anonymous member does. But at night while I'm sleeping, that pride fairy just blows me up until that prideful balloon it talks about in the 12 and 12, you know, hovering above the crowd, you know, using my education or my arrogance or my judgment to hover above other people. You know, I want to be right sized. And thank God I've got a sponsor that keeps me right sized and you people in this program, right? So that I can be teachable. And guess what? I have Chip as my new boss. He's everything they said he was going to be. But guess what? Chip loves me. You know why? because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned how to be a good employee. And when he sends me those emails about my labor, I say, okay, Chip, I'll work on it. I mean, it's hard, right? Like, I really have to work my spiritual program. And quite honestly, I'm okay with a B spiritual program. I don't want to work that hard to have the A spiritual program I have to be with Chip. You know what I mean? Like, have to always look at myself and always answer. But you know what? Saying okay is spiritual. The saying, okay, you know what? I'm going to try that. And you know, that's what my experience has been in this program, right? You know, it's just, I'm willing. I love this program. I want to welcome the newcomers. I thought it was the worst thing in the world to be an alcoholic. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. And I'm grateful to be here. And thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. Our main speaker tonight is Judy C.
Good evening. My name is Judy. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I am thrilled to be here tonight. A very special night for me and for all of us who've been lucky enough to get into this incredible program. I want to thank our speakers, and it was wonderful to hear you, both Nancy and James. And Nancy, you're very funny. And it was so sweet to hear you both and inspiring. It made me think, you know, I want to be teachable. I wanted to learn growing up, but I didn't understand what it meant to be teachable. I always knew what was good for you. You know, I had a lot of advice for lots of people. I was the oldest of five, so it gave me sort of a learning process of how to try to tell other people what to do. And my siblings were having none of it most of the time. I was raised in an alcoholic family, of course. Well, not of course. There are a lot of people who come on here and say they weren't. I just sometimes think they misunderstood, but never mind. That's just me. Alcoholism, sometimes for all of us, for some of us, but for a lot of us, I could misinterpret. I mean, I think what happens to teenagers is interesting. Now, I have a son who died of this disease when he was 33 years old. And when he was a little boy, he was, we would call it HDAD, I don't know what it's called really, but he was hyperactive. I think that's what they called it. And actually he was an alcoholic. He was a little wonderful, beautiful, gorgeous, beautiful work in progress, headed for brilliance and drug addiction. And I think when he was a teenager, it's very hard when you're a teenager to tell what it is because the hormones are racing around your body. So I, as a teenager, I had depression. I had all kinds of issues. I was a very disciplined child. I wanted to, as I said, be teachable. I wanted to learn, but I was depressed. So depressed that when I was 14, I tried to kill myself. And I've thought about it a lot because it's an issue in my life since my son took his life at 33. And I know that alcoholics and drug addicts and people who have mental illness of various kinds are prone to kill themselves. And there were all those years when I was in therapy talking endlessly about my drinking, although I was with therapists who believed that if you needed to give yourself a break, if you were depressed, if you're unhappy, you should have a little few drinks. Of course, I stayed with that group of therapists for 15 years because I did talk. I always knew I was alcoholic. I started to, after I survived my own suicide, which was miraculous in a way, I fully intended to get out of here and to do it as fast as possible. But I got sick from the pills I was taking and I was not willing to throw up. I was willing to die, but I was not willing to throw up. So I guess I had to pay for that by having years of bulimia, but that's another story altogether, but it is a part of my addiction. So it is interesting to bring up these different threads which contribute to the disaster that my life became with alcohol. And I was also raised in a brilliant family. My father was brilliant. My sister and I were talking the other day about families and about where we came from and who we are and so on. We were talking about about people who had no sense of goodness and no, and only of evil? And how did they get to stay in the world? We often talk a lot about that. And she said, you know, Dad was honest and he was insightful and he was brilliant and he was funny and he was willing to say, I'm sorry. He apologized, by the way. He wrote me an apology after I tried to kill myself. Interesting that my mother saved that letter all these years, and I have it, and I once in a while read it. And it's an astonishing thing that he sent that to me, and what he said, and how he said it, and that he apologized for being hard on his kids, and to want them to be the best, and to discipline them in sense in ways that some of us would look at nowadays as being unacceptable. You know, there was a razor strap in the bathroom that I somehow felt on my rear end, but he was a good man. He had ethics. He had principles. He was also talented and brilliant, so on. But he was an alcoholic, and he was up against something. He had no clue what he was up. He had no sense of how this monster had gotten in the door, and certainly we didn't know anything about it. So there's so much richness in my life, and I know many of us have that same experience. That there's such a depth of things that went on that were good, combined with, ye gods, am I going to live through this? Which obviously I didn't want to do for some time. But, you know, when I got through that suicide attempt with my father's apology, and I wouldn't be amazed to find that that was psychologically very, very important, was that apology. You know, when people take you through, when you're going through the steps and you make an amend to someone, it has a vast and, I think, urgent effect on the world, not just on the person you're making an amend to, but on everybody in your, those who can't, who you can't see, you can't hear, you can't know. It goes into the universe. And that's why I think that people who get sober, those of us who are lucky enough to find a spiritual path and to find the release from the gorilla, and, you know, they say the circus is gone, but the gorilla is still in town. And the gorilla is addiction, and we do have to look at it. That's why we have to go to meetings. That's why I'm here tonight. That's why you're here tonight, because you know that we forget in a 24-hour period. We kind of think we got it, you know. What could be bad? But then X, Y, and Z come along. We know that we have to be here. We have to have meetings. We have to read the literature. We have to pray. We have to meditate. We have to. I have a resentment. Now, I'm sober now. My sobriety date is April 20th, 1978. So I'm now 43 years sober. And so you'd think I'd know better than to have a resentment, but I do. And I try to work on, I will do something more about it than I've done. But I want you to know that perfection does not come with the years. Many, many other things come with the years. And those of you who are new, you have to hear, even if you don't get it, you have to hear this is the best thing that ever happened to you. That you are in the hot room. You are where it's the best show in town. You are here where, you know, you're not going to find anything better than this. And I'm sorry, I disagree with people who say, oh, well, there are many roads to this. You know, it doesn't matter. It does matter. And this is the only place that knows how to do it. I drank when I was 19. I realized I was alcoholic. I knew it because I felt that hole in my gut that I knew that I saw in my father. I knew that there was that place where despair lived and where rage lived and where despair lived and where tears lived and also where joy lived. But I saw that hole in my gut and I knew I was in trouble. But I also figured that I'd been given this kind of job, and it was to drink, and it was to be professional, which is how I was trained. I was trained in every way with wonderful, wonderful teachers. I was musically, I had some tendencies that were the good kind. And so those were appreciated, and I was given the lessons and the people that I could study with. And I had to work enormously hard from the time I was about five, and I still do that. I still do what I did when I was a kid, which is to practice half the day and think about creativity. And that was, my father was a creative man. He was made his living in that industry of entertaining and having the talent to do that. And of course, he was an alcoholic, so he had to work through that. And I learned how to do that from him. I watched him. I watched him always show up on time. I watched him always get up happy, always singing, always being positive. And then, of course, there were times when, and it didn't matter how much he drank the night before. And also that he worked solidly. He was a workaholic. And I learned how to do that when I was a drunk. And I was a drunk. When I started to see this, all I knew was that I had to do it. That it didn't matter what I thought about it. I don't think I thought about it. But I knew that the job was to keep working, to never be late, to never not show up. I make my living in music and always have. And never not to show up, always be there. You know, do more than anybody else does. So that you can drink. One of the things is you can drink. You know, if you show up and behave yourself and always sort of look as though you knew what was happening, I think I had a lot of practice in coming out of blackouts and saying, hi, how are you? To people who were stunned, because just before that, they'd been talking to this insane person beforehand who was clearly out there somewhere in the never, never land, but suddenly came forth with. Now, I have to tell you a funny story. Mary and I go back 44 years, because we met the year I was still drinking, and she was, well, I won't talk about her drinking, only mine. But she and I have known each other all those years, and to have had that experience with somebody that you drank with in a very serious way, and not for a whole long time, for a short time, because we knew each other in a professional capacity, but we were slam dunk drunk. And it's so great to see her and be with her and be here. And that's what happened to my life when I got into the program, was all of a sudden the lights came on. And so I was in the dark for all these years, working, having a great deal of success. Who knows if these things are earned? I don't know. I think it's luck and timing and a lot of things. My son, God bless him, think about him every day. And he was very special. He was one of those sparkly babies, sparkly and beautiful. And you knew that when he showed up, he was really up for it. You know, he was smart and funny and beautiful looking and a problem. And he finally, when I was 6 years sober, he was a drug dealer in New York, and he had had a long history of drug addiction. And he came to me one morning, sat at this table that I'm sitting at right now. And he said, forgive me if I'm not sequential. My mind is starting to bounce around a lot, which is fine. And he said, okay, Mom, I'm ready. And I said, what do you want to do? And he said, well, I want to go to Hazelden, which he did. And he went there, and it was heaven. You know, it was after all these years of the other shoe, waiting for the other shoe to drop and so on. And by that time, being sober myself, it's never easy, but I think it's at least when you're sober in the program, you have some sense of, first of all, you have Al-Anon. So you know you can't tell a kid what to do. You can't tell anybody what to do, it seems. And he was sober for 6 years and almost 7 years, actually, and we had a wonderful time. It was delicious, and couldn't have dreamed anything better. And then one day I got a call from he came to my door and told me that my son was dead. And, you know, it's funny. It's not funny, but it's heartbreaking, but odd that it just about tore my life apart. Now, I knew about suicide, and I know that people who drink and use drugs and have mental illness are prone to suicide. But it's one of those things, I'll tell you, suicide's interesting if you're not having it nearby. It's fascinating in a lot of ways because it's always been the option. I mean, from the time I started reading Camus when I was a teenager, and he said suicide is the single philosophical issue that men and women have to deal with, or people as they call us nowadays. It is something to deal with. It's a big, big, big thing to deal with in your family, and it's harmful, and it really was going to destroy me. I got a phone call from a friend, a very close friend, who'd had a suicide in her life. And she said, you can't give up your career. You cannot shut everything down. I was prepared to do so. But she said, there aren't any guilts in suicide, and you have to work or you won't recover, which I discovered. And I was sober. So thank God that information got through to my thick head. And so I would say that all of my years, alcohol saved my life. It helped me to get through my anxiety about life and through my depression, which was clearly there when I tried to kill myself as a kid. And I was always up and down and sideways. And you know, anyway, when I was in therapy for years, I started talking about this, all the secrets. And of course, being in therapy, although I was a therapist, with therapists who didn't understand alcoholism, although a lot of them were alcoholics. But I think the fact that I could talk about all these things. I could talk about my suicide attempt. I could talk about my father's rages. I could talk about all the things that were going on in my life. And on the other hand, I know that because of all the blackouts and all the drinking and all the constant total disregard. I mean, I never stopped drinking for a minute. I mean, I did try to stop eating certain things because I had a weight problem. I mean, it was a handful of pounds that I didn't like and I didn't want to live with. And so I went to every length I could to find a way to get through that. And now I have another 12-step program that works for me about that, in case you know me, you don't know. And of course you do probably. And so I could talk about all these things. And so the therapist really did help me a lot. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're here together, is that we can all talk about what went on. Why did I drink? I know why I drank, because I'm an alcoholic and I got the gene. And some people don't have it. I have a brother who doesn't drink. I've had three brothers. One of them is gone, God bless him. And two others. And one of them just stopped drinking about 35 years ago. And he says to me, he's so wonderful. He's such a wonderful man, always has been. But he used to he'd drive over cliffs and fall off buildings. And I mean, just really a disaster drunk. And I live in New York, so I didn't have to drive. So I wasn't driving over the cliff. But he stopped drinking one day, and he'll say to me, you know, forgive my language, you know, I've got 35 years and I never had to go to those goddamn meetings. Now, he would love these meetings. I know that. You know that. This is the best, as I said, show in town. And so there I was, working away, having successes, having wonderful, wonderful things happen to me. And then suddenly, you know, I don't know if you saw the Hemingway biography, but if you did, you might have noticed that the only person who said anything that made sense in that show was Mary Carr, who said, well, that's because he was an alcoholic. And she said, and that's what happens to them. They drink and they drink and they drink, and then they die or they get sober. I mean, that's about it. That's about, yes, there are great artists in the world. There are wonderful things to do to show that you have a place on the planet. You have a reason to be on the planet. But this is the reason to be on the planet for me, is to be in AA. And it's not, I didn't win this contest. I mean, none of us did. We just got lucky. We got touched, as they say in some of the old timey religions. We got touched. Why is it that many, many times that angel has come to the window and we've said, oh, not today? Many, many times I've had a glimpse somewhere. So why did I say this? Well, I was intervened. I had an Eskimo who I talked to, and he said, you have to go and see this doctor, and you have to go to these meetings, and you have to, I went to this doctor and he wore a white suit. I thought, oh, here's another guy who can give me anything I want. I had a bottle of Quaaludes this big in my cabinet when I got sober. I never touched it because I'm actually positively terrified of drugs. You know, I thought they would interfere with my drinking. So that's why I never used very many drugs, except all the uppers, downers, and sideways that I had in my pocketbook, which my fancy East Side doctors would give me. Oh, you're not an alcoholic. You have success. You look too good. Yeah. By the way, if you had looked at me then, you would have said, get her to a nunnery or a rehab or something. Get her off the street. So I did go to the doctor, Dr. Gitlow, famous in New York because he was one of the only doctors in the business of prescribing and taking care of sick people who knew what alcoholism was and knew how to help us. And so it was him that sent me to the treatment center that I went to, which was called Chit Chat. I very much resented the name, but you know, I was dying. I couldn't work. I had had terrible, terrible losing everything. I couldn't sing, which is how I make my living. That was gone. My jobs were gone. My friends were gone. I hadn't worked in a year probably when I came in, and I had another year during which I didn't work. So that was a gift because I came home from, oh, and I will tell you, sometimes people say you have to include that part, and sometimes I forget. I got to Chit Chat on a morning, on the morning of April 19th of 1978, and I had been flown there with the two people that were speaking to me, an assistant and a lawyer. No, he was a, what do you call, money guy. And they got on the plane with me at 4:30 in the morning. You know, I was, you know, they were hoping that I wasn't going to, you know, fly into the wilderness or something. They went to make sure I got where I was supposed to go. And I got to the airport. I was very drunk. I've been drinking since, you know, this was a time when I couldn't not drink. When I had first called Chit Chat, they said, you have to be 72 hours sober. I said, you don't understand. That's not possible. And she hung up on me. And she called me back a little while later. She said, oh, we have a detox here. So you can come as drunk as you want. And I did. I was as drunk as I ever had been that morning. And by the way, I was at the point where I couldn't actually get drunk or get sober. So it was a gift that I was able to get drunk to get on that plane. And I carried with me, of course, this big fat jelly jar full of vodka. And I got to 7:30, we landed, you know, and I just was so happy. I was so drunk. And the little kid, the guy, the teenager, it seemed to me, who came to get me, he knew who I was right away. And he said, you're headed for Chit Chat, aren't you? And I said, yes. And he put me in the station wagon. I loaded in my luggage. I had a typewriter. I had a bag full of books. I had another bag full of clothes and vitamins. I took a lot of vitamins. And we got to the beautiful, beautiful place. It's a beautiful place, Chit Chat. It's now called Care, and that's where they take you for family issues. That's what they call it. They're actually going to sneak you into the rehab for alcoholism if you don't know any better. And so I got this gorgeous, gorgeous place near Wernersville, Pennsylvania. It looks like a house from some special magazine that features gorgeous houses in the woods. And I got there and took me down to where the nurse's office was. And she gave me this little kind of paper robe, I think, and some slippers. And she gave me a cup of coffee and they took away my suitcase. I watched it go. They took away my typewriter and all this, these books, and they said, we're going to take charge of all your vitamins. I don't know. I never saw those again. And she sat me down there and I was sitting there for a while drinking that cup of coffee. And then she looked at me and she said, Okay. Why don't you let us drive? And I did. Why I could is another mystery about the angel coming to the window and saying, well, I'm here again. What about it? And my defenses were down. And I said, okay. And I started doing the work and going to the meeting, 6 a.m. meditation meeting. And it was spring. It was April. Now, I hadn't seen anything that had any color or light or beauty or optimism or inspiration. I hadn't seen it. I hadn't had an insight for years. The last 4 years of my drinking were the tundra. They were dark, dark, gray, verging on black. And so suddenly I saw flowers blooming. And by the time I got out of there, I had, the woman who ran the, you know, in those days, they would give you a job in the rehab. And so the woman who was running it said, I'm not going to put you in the dining room. I don't want you staring. I don't want people staring at you. You're going to drive that garbage truck. I said, oh my God, I love to drive. And I did. Had she known how much I loved this job, she would have fired me immediately. I sent home for my driving gloves, and George and I drove. He hauled the garbage cans, and I drove the truck, and we told each other our stories. And he had a great, sensational drinking story. And so he and I laughed, hollered with laughter, cruised around the campus in the morning. I think it was, 6 a.m. or something. And we picked up all the garbage and we told each other our stories. And by the time I came back, I went straight to the meeting at Lenox Hill, which I have gone to for all these 43 years. And I do it on Zoom now with some other meetings in the city, in the country, in the world. And I went straight back there. And all of a sudden, over the course of the next, 43 years, it changed my life completely and totally. And it was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. But I did it. I knew I was done. I was cooked. I don't know that I could have been medically claimed as finished and over physically, but I was done. I had seen these dark, terrible places, been in them, not only looked at them, not only read about them, but lived in them and knew that I was really on the edge there of the brink. I had my own Bowery in this apartment, actually. I've lived here 50 years, so this has seen a lot of my history here. And I had a closet full of half-gallon bottles of vodka, cases of half gallons of vodka, because I didn't want to run out. So when they cleared out the booth, my brother picked me up and brought me home, the one who's gone now, not of alcoholism. He died sober. And he took the booze out and he said he never drank it. He said he poured it out because he didn't think it was good luck to drink it. And I started my journey. I had met my husband, who didn't know how much I mean, of course he knows now, but he didn't know when he met me what shape I was in. And I'm awfully grateful for that. And I'm grateful for my 43 years of being with him. And we have on our rings the night that we met, which was 4 days before I went into treatment at Chit Chat. And so Lewis has been my lifetime partner. And I mean, this is the lifetime. I mean, the previous was a preview. How could it be so good and then get so bad? I mean, that's a movie in itself. We've seen it. We've lived it. Most of us have seen both ends of that tunnel. And so those of us who have come out on this side where there's light and where there's joy and sharing and, you know, I know a lot of interesting people who are not alcoholics, and they seem to have a real grip on it. A lot of them are smart. A lot of them are visionary. A lot of them seem to be comfortable in their own skins. But those of them, of us who were alcoholic people before getting a sober life, we see both sides of it. I never had the chance to have a sane life. When I got into, I couldn't believe how calm everything was after I got sober. I was stunned by that aspect of this, that the drama that I had lived with all the time from a childhood, it was a very dramatic household, you can imagine. I mean, he was blind, my father, but he was completely, he didn't use a dog, he didn't use a cane. He went everywhere on his own. He was successful. He was not your, he wasn't a picture of what might be the idea of who he was. And he was a rageaholic. So the family was a place of a lot of fighting and a lot of negativity, except when it was great fun and hooray and wonderful and delicious and optimistic. But when I got sober, the calm today, I mean, I'm going to go to sleep tonight and sleep like a log, get up very early and have a great day. And I can today, because I'm not drinking, I can count on that. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to see something unusual. I'm going to learn something from somewhere that's really invisible today. And I don't care about not being able to see around the corner. I can be happy being here today with you. I want to thank Mary and all of you who run these wonderful meetings and tell you that I wish I could be with you all physically in California at the place where you're meeting. I don't even know where you're meeting right now, the Pacific group, but I quite often go to the Atlantic group here in New York. I knew and loved everybody there, so many wonderful people. And I have been to meetings in Los Angeles and I have a lot of connections out there, but I'm so grateful to Mary and to you and to the fact that this is here and we can all come here and share our lives together and our stories together and get home without getting a DUI on the way or crashing into the neighbor's car or garage or, you know, stumbling into bed, not knowing where we were. A lot of the times I was with people that I shouldn't have been with, and God knows what kind of dangerous territory I was in. I don't know if some of us will get to go to some sort of, for instance, backwards therapy where you figure out your past lives therapy, where you can figure out who it was you slept with, you know, when you were stone cold drunk. But I'm never going to do that because it's a waste of time. But I know that I was in jeopardy a lot of the time. I see that it's time to say goodnight. And so I'll say God bless Clancy, whom I adored. And I saw him many times and loved his story, loved the Midnight Mission. I still send some money there once in a while and think of him when I do. And think of those days in LA in the early days when I got to hear him speak. Anyway, it's wonderful to be with you all. I wish you all blessed days and nights and blessed abstinence and sobriety. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you. May we now have the announcements from our secretary.
Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. We celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If you're a regular attendee of this meeting, you'd like to take a cake with us, please email Kimberly K at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org by noon on Wednesday. Otherwise, you have to wait for the following week. And we have several birthdays tonight. And this week, we've asked our speaker, Judy C., to sing happy birthday to the celebrants.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, alcoholic. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Okay, so now the birthdays. Here we go. Okay, so our first birthday is for Julia H. for 1 year, and Sarah A. is her sponsor. Our second birthday is for Stephanie C. for 9 years, and Kimberly K. is her sponsor. Our third birthday is for Jim D. for 13 years, and Paul C. is his sponsor. And our fourth birthday is for Terry L. for 20 years, and Betty H. is her sponsor. Becky G. for 27 years, and Sharon C. is her sponsor. And Gail E. for 40 years, and Leon T. is her sponsor. And 40 years for a former secretary of the Pacific Group and the Poop Sheet author, Charlie C. for 40 years, and Bob R. is his sponsor. And happy birthday, that's a total of 7 cakes with 150 years of sobriety. And the average years is 21.43. So thank you very much.